My name is Clancy Immersland, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi.
Very glad to be here. I want to thank Annette's boys for having me come down. I'm always nice to her starting about in December, just so she'll mention my name at the family get-togethers. I want to apologize. I know some people are a little shocked that at a romantic spot like this, people would wear a shirt and tie, and I don't do it to impress you, and I don't think the other speakers should do it, and I probably will never do it again. But when I was new, I was trained that when you speak at an AA meeting, you wear a shirt and tie, and nobody cares where it is. And so I'd rather disdain your approval or disapproval of my tie and shirt rather than have a wraith come down in the night and twist my nose or something. As I told you to wear a tie at a meeting. But I'm glad to be here tonight. This is a remarkable gathering, of course, as these affairs are, of Alcoholics Anonymous. And it's an amazing thing how similar many of us are and how we have spent our lives convinced that we truly are different. You know, it's an amazing thing today, after all of the progress in the field of the treatment of alcoholism, certainly the 55 years of Alcoholics Anonymous, in conjunction with many hospitals, many treatment facilities, AA is, pardon me, all over the world now, in Russia, despite the efforts of those who have come to bring it there. I don't mean that in a bad sense. I just mean that AA usually is not advanced most places by groups posing for pictures to run in papers. That is not the way AA operates. In fact, the first group in Moscow sent their first squad over to the United States a year or so ago. Four members of the Moscow group. And the first place they talked in America was the Pacific Group in Los Angeles. And they had four guys, they had a little blonde interpreter, and they had some renegade Episcopalian priest who acted as their duenna. And it was kind of funny because these guys would get up and say things like, Starbada! Maramiel! Dasvatonya! And the little interpreter would bounce up and say, he says he loves you very much. You just get the feeling he's not saying that. He's something about burying my grandchildren, I think is what I heard him say. But it's great. They have AA everywhere. And it's certainly in the United States. And if you have insurance, you can get good treatment without going to AA. If you can't afford treatment, there are individual counselors behind every bush. And so there's no need for anyone to die drunk anymore, as there used to be. And yet, authorities seem to be generally accepting, or at least the ones I know, that maybe in America, the hotbed of AA in the world, I think about that sometimes, you know. America is certainly the hotbed of AA in the world. And in America, certainly the hotbed of AA is the West Coast now. And certainly the hotbed of the West Coast is Southern California. Because I'm not saying that because I lived there. I'm just saying that there are more AAs in Southern California than in New York and Ohio combined. That's where the hotbed of AA is. There's still a few people who are kind of new who think Akron, Ohio, you know. Well, isn't Akron, Ohio, isn't that the hotbed of AA? AA's relationship to Akron, Ohio is about the same as Christianity's relationship to Bethlehem. Something nice happened there once, but not for a long time. But in Southern California, where no one should ever die drunk, I guess the percentage must be about the same there as it seems to be nationally, maybe still 90% or more of alcoholics die drunk in America, in the hotbed of recovery more than any place in the world. And it's just staggering. Why should this be? Unlike some of you, I see alcoholics die regularly. When I say I see them die, I don't mean I see them die in some metaphysical sense. I mean where we say put a blanket over this guy and get him out of here, because they're dead. Why would people die? I see people, these people dying, and rightfully or wrongfully, I have some reputation as being a communicator of Alcoholics Anonymous, a little bit. I've been at it a long time anyway, and I've been a lot of places in the world, and I've been in the South Seas and Tahiti and New Zealand and England and Ireland and Scotland and Canada and Mexico, and a lot of places where I've been asked to go communicate the message of AA, and certainly in all the states of the Union and all the places. And I'm supposed to be some kind of a hotshot speaker communicator. And it's really frustrating when I see a guy who I know and like, and he is dying in front of my eyes, and I can't even get to him. You'd think, where's the big hotshot communicator now? Why don't you communicate to him if you're such a damn good communicator? And I can't communicate with him, because he's enmeshed in something that is just overpowering. I sometimes, years ago, wanted to just grab these guys and say, hey, you don't have to be like this. You don't have to lie here in agony and misery. Why do you do this? Why do you do this? And then it took me a while to remember, why did I do it? Why did I, year after year after year, while good men, good AAs, top people, tried to help me, and their help got nowhere with me. And I think back, why didn't their help have any effect on me? Because of the same thing that keeps that man dying, and of something that I've come to believe is present in all of us. And it gets a little more latent, it takes a little nap from time to time, but it's there. If you don't believe it's there, wait till the next time you're feeling bad, or feeling put upon, or feeling hurt, or feeling less than, all the old negative emotions, and watch that feeling come back. And it's nothing big and dramatic, it's nothing remarkable, it's no big deal. It's that little thing that all of us feel that, left to its own devices, will eventually kill us. It just says this: I know they mean well, but my case is different. My case is different. I am convinced that is the number one killer of people like you and me. I am convinced that's what makes people, because when you get immersed in that obsession, there is no data, there is no information, there is nothing can get to you. No communicator can help you. And the feeling of different is one that, it's really a paradoxical thing, because each of us feel we are the only ones who really understand the depth of that feeling, and it is truly one of the unifying feelings of all of us. We all have it at one time or another. Now I look back over my life, why did I feel so different? I look at my life now, and it's kind of an amazing thing. Much of my life I thought AA was a nice place designed for them. In the last few years, I've come to believe AA was designed specifically for me, and if it helps somebody else, I'm glad for them. But it is designed for me. It fits me like a glove. Now, why was I so different? What made me think I was so different? Why did I, year after year, nod with a feeling of absolute desperation, and these old fools would prate at me while I was in some place where I had to pretend to listen, and people come up to me and say, well, you should go to A&A. And I didn't want to tell them, I've been to A&A, and A&A is not my cup of tea, because there's something different about me that I can't make out quite what it is. I can sometimes, but other times it isn't that, isn't it? I spent much of my life examining myself. I thought if I'd ever been given any gift by fate, it was the gift of self-analysis. And I didn't want to waste that gift, so I used it as much as I could. But how do you really feel? Isn't it true you just think you're feeling good? And on and on. I spent a lot of time examining myself, and I came to discover things about myself. I don't know if I ever put them in words at the time. You know, that's one of the problems about AA in a sense. Speakers always get up and they have the advantage of speaking ex post facto with 20/20 hindsight, so you can wrap up everything in little packages. And then I realized that things were taking a turn for the worse, and so I... And it isn't that way when you're going through it. You just... A lot of the time, you just look around and say, oh, Jesus. And your head starts, calls a committee meeting. What do we do now? I don't know. What do you think we ought to do? I don't know. I've heard people in AA say they've gone to group therapy. All I've ever had to do is go for a ride alone in my car, boy. That's true. Right, the heat is on. Pressure's on. But in... So I can carefully give tags to these differences I see now in retrospect. But at the time, they were just amorphous feelings that I don't know that I ever named him or ever tried to name him, but I just felt it, such as. It always seemed clear to me that I felt things too intensely, more than other people apparently did, as far as I could judge by listening to them and talking to them. I never asked them, but I remember at my first AA meeting many, many years ago, I knew I was an alcoholic. I had been sent there because some people thought I was. And some guy said to me, he said, do you think you're an alcoholic, kid? I said, nope, not really. He said, well, what do you think your problem is? I said, I think I'm too sensitive. And he did exactly what you did. He laughed. Now, I'll tell you something. I never told anybody that again. But all of my life, I knew it was true, but I never told anybody. And that's one of the things I remember now. When new people come to me and they say, I think I'm too sensitive, part of me wants to laugh, but part of me remembers, if I do, I may shut this guy out. Because he's trying to be honest for the first time, maybe in years. And if I laugh at him, he won't know it's a kindly laugh. It'll be the same old sneering public humiliation that inferior people get accustomed to and hate. But I never told anybody I felt sensitive again, but I always felt sensitive. But I wouldn't tell anybody, and because I didn't want to be laughed at. When you're feeling rotten, you don't want to be laughed at. I'd rather be killed than be laughed at when I'm feeling inadequate and publicly humiliated. One of the things about that is that it makes you very susceptible to rejection, because you must... It's something that I didn't discover. I was sober a while. I heard in a guy's inventory once, and I thought, how did this goof ever understand this? And I didn't. But there's a funny phenomenon. I look over my life, and it's certainly true. When you're feeling less than, or when you're feeling different, or when you're feeling that you're playing catch-up most of the time without telling them, there's a funny little test you get in the world. You don't even know it. I never knew it till I was sober years, and then I saw it. And I still find myself guilty of it once in a while. Because I want to tell you something. All the emotions I talk to you about are not circa 1946. They are, some of them, there today. And they will be there next week and next month. What AA has allowed me to do is identify them and reduce the intensity and reduce the frequency. But I've always been a little suspect of the people who come here sans emotions. You know, I no longer have anger. I no longer have hatred. When I was kind of new, I heard a guy say that at the Beverly Hills meeting and held at the Legion Hall many, many years ago. And I went up afterwards, and I was in one of my bad moods anyway. So I pretended to stumble. I laid a cup of coffee down the front of his suit. And I was so pleased, he regained anger, he regained hatred. And he told me I was a clumsy son of a bitch, if you could imagine. But one of the things that I've always been troubled with, I know in retrospect. Intuitively, it seems to me, I insist that people treat me special. If you treat me special, I'll feel average. If you treat me average, I'll feel rejected. And never knew it. Never knew it. So you got to keep changing friends. You got to keep going to new places. You got to keep acting smart aleck, and you got to be glib and clever when you don't feel it. Because, and the point, you get around a group of people and they treat you special, and one day you come in the door and they don't say, "Hi, Clance." I say, "Oh, hi, Clancy." Now they've accepted you now. You become accepted, so they treat you normally. But to me, that means they no longer like me. Something's happened. I've offended them. So I go on to the next place, little by little. Now, when you insist the world treats you special, you're always going to wind up rejected because the world isn't going to treat you special all the time. Nobody, nothing. So you always wind up feeling rejected again. I did. I could see rejection in glances and tones of voice that less fortunate people could not notice. I've been troubled much of my life by anxiety, waves of anxiety. As I've often said, I know that other people get anxiety, but they have anxiety they can identify. They say, "Boy, I'm behind in my house payment. I'm really anxious." I get anxiety like that when there's nothing wrong. I don't know what the hell's wrong. It's just, so you can't talk about it. Somebody might say, "What's wrong?" "I don't know. You're goofy, that's what's wrong, you know." It's almost a blessing when something bad happens so you can say, "I guess I saw that coming. I've been given a gift." You know, I've never done this at a podium before, and I'll never do it again, but since we're here on such a fun weekend, let me give you my impression of Joe, the left-handed Indian. No, I mean this. I did it wrong. Well, shit. Shut up. If you're listening to the tape, you didn't miss anything, I'll tell you that. One of the problems in my life has been I'm troubled a lot by loneliness. I seem to have been, and I still am once in a while. It isn't a loneliness that's, now I know everybody gets lonely, but they get lonely when they're alone. I get waves of loneliness when I'm in the middle of crowds of people, especially if they're strangers, or especially if I'm not involved in what they're doing. I was thinking about that, you know, you go to a strange town, you sit in a meeting, in the middle of the meeting, and you're in AA, and it's great, you feel at home, but sometimes you just feel, "What am I doing here? This is, I'm alone here, I want to get out of here." And a lot of places that can happen. And I thought, I never knew that it happened to other people. When I get feeling lonely in the middle of crowds of people, I have a tendency to withdraw, which makes me feel worse, which makes me withdraw, so I feel worse, and the time has come little by little over a period of time. I work myself into a depression and self-pity mode. I haven't done it recently, but I've done it probably over 100 times in my life, where I can't bear to get up in the morning. I just can't face it. And I have to tell somebody, tell my wife, call in and tell them I'm sick. Tell them I got the flu. Just feel depressed and bad and sad. And that's hard to explain to your loved ones. You say, "What are you doing under the covers?" "I'm lonely." And you're going to stay lonely too forever, you know. And there's not much you can do. You can't get in an argument with them. The only thing I've ever been able to do is hold the covers with one hand and get one hand free if you could. Just feel terrible. Now, I know other people aren't like that. I remember sitting in a big advertising agency in Dallas 30-some years ago, where I was supposed to be a hot shot, and I was. And feeling terrible, this has always been etched in my brain, because it's a perfect example of, outside my door was the secretary, and she's talking to one of her friends down the hall. She said something about, "I was just so lonely last night. I called up Betty Jean, and we went to the show and had a wonderful evening." And I didn't say anything, but I looked at her through the door and I thought to myself, I would give anything to be simple like you, you bitch. You know, just sort of grind, feelings of loneliness and despair and all kinds of feelings of inadequacy, feelings of a peculiar feeling that I never identified when I was sober, and I heard somebody talking about a meeting. I've come to believe that most people have had it. A lifetime of two feelings, feeling inferior to some people and envying them and resenting them, and feeling superior to others and feeling contemptuous to them. So you're always above or below. There's the only time you're ever equal is you go by, you know. But I've never felt equal for any length of time to people. I just don't feel, I have many, many times in the last few years, but I spent much of my life thinking, where is it I fit? I have spent my life moving, going, changing, looking for the place I fit. Because if I could find that, I could be something. I always start out well wherever I am, but pretty soon it fades. And something else I know that I look back in my life, I have spent nearly all of my life, not much lately because I know better now, but for a long time, it seemed to me that there was something about me that required more out of life than other people seem to require. It's almost as though I had to have, well, a few years ago I was working on a radio TV station in Hollywood. I was sitting there watching, we were screening some stuff before we put on the air. This was an NFL thing before a playoff game between Dallas and Green Bay. Remember that? They were showing the history of the NFL and black and white movies of Bronco Nagurski and up through the 40s and Otto Graham and then the 50s and the Bears. And in 1962, they were showing a game, the Packers and the Cleveland Browns in black and white, and it showed Jim Taylor cracking into the line. And just as he hit the line, technically, the whole thing became technicolor. They moved to a full-color film to show the new era of football, just boom. And I thought about that later. I thought, that's exactly what I've been looking for and I've seek and sometimes find in my life. An ability to change the black and white of life into the color that I seem to need. That's why I drink. That's why I go places. I want to find. All I want is, damn it, for things to be wonderful. I didn't know I wanted things to be wonderful, but that's what I wanted. I want things to be wonderful. I want things to be in technicolor. To this day, I sometimes see that part of me. Christmas time. Now, it used to be my children. Now it's my grandchildren. I sit in my big chair and simulate interest in watching Over the Rainbow, Wizard of Oz, and I must have watched that damn movie 50 times now, and I've never once got to the end of it without thinking, don't go back to Kansas. You know, that's black, it's worse than black and white, it's sepia. It's technicolor here. There may be wicked witches, but you get used to them, I did. You know. But I never understood that something else I learned after I was sober. I spent my life trying to keep things wonderful. And after I was sober, I discovered it is impossible to keep things wonderful. Because things don't stay wonderful after you're used to them. Nothing. Nothing. The new car one day becomes just a car. The new house becomes the house. The exciting new job becomes the job. The new love affair becomes just the affair after a while. You know, I tell young guys that when they call me, you know, I hate to tell them, I say, I think this is the one. We were having lunch and we reached for the salt and our fingers touched and it was almost like a spark. I just, and I hate to tell them, you know, I know it seems that way, kid, but it's hard to believe this, but in 3 years from now, you may be married to her and have two children, for all I know, and you may be deeply in love, but it isn't going to stay this way. You're going to be having lunch, you're going to reach for the salt, and your hands are going to touch, and you're going to say, give me the goddamn salt. It's just part of life. It's part of life. And perpetual adolescents like me feel terrible when that happens. What's happened to her? I've always wanted to be something. I've always had a great ambition. When I see that much ambition in new guys now, I know they're ill, because that much ambition indicates you just don't have enough inside, so you got to get more and more reinforcement on the outside to show them. Not for me to live more comfortably, to show them. And you can't live with these emotions. Your continual conflict-provoking emotions, and these and many other emotions. Always the bubbling pot. And so I went to psychoanalysis when I was a young guy, starting out as an executive. I discovered a lot of things. I discovered things I had never guessed. I discovered I'd been religiously repressed as a child. I had never known that. I thought I had a pleasant childhood. I found out I was scarred dreadfully. Raised by the Norwegian Lutheran Church. Terrible, mean church. I always liked it until I went bad. I discovered that I'd been deprived as a child. In fact, if I knew then what I know now, I would have formed adult children of Norwegian Lutherans. Now that sounds funny, but alcoholics pass out or leave, but Norwegian Lutherans stay there all the time and just say, what are you doing now? It gives you trauma, my doctor told me. I discovered I'd been deprived as a child. I hadn't known that. See, I discovered that I had never had anything. I used to go to the doctor's office sometimes and just have a few drinks. It's amazing I'm doing as well as I am. Christ, I've had a terrible life. Just hideous. And I discovered a lot of things because I operate on the basis then as I have much of my life. If I can just find out why I have these feelings, it's going to make a turn for the better. And I discovered a lot of things in psychoanalysis. Things that enabled me to talk knowledgeably about my illness at length. I also, later on, I was getting sicker and I had to go to the whip. So I got into metaphysics, and I got deeply into the meaning of the infinite and my relation, my oneness to the universe. I was about half goofy then, so I had a real head start on this. And at one time, I don't like to gloat. It's hard enough to sit in these meetings without having the speaker gloat. But at one time, to the best of my knowledge, I was one of six people in the state of Texas who knew truth. And they were so jealous, they put me in the state insane asylum. Not for drinking, for being insane. I read books, I read Nietzsche, I did a lot of things. Because I've always been, if I can just find out why. Now I'm sure there's a lot of people in this room. We have 2 1-year birthdays tonight. Don't know why they should have been here. We know, because you missed your cake, you goof. So Robin and Stacy, wherever you are, bring that cake to my room and I'll eat it after the meeting. But why? I'm sure there's a lot of people in this room because it's a very common phenomenon. Why do I feel this way? Why? Not so much now when I'm sunny and full of ocean, but when I get back to Bridgeport, Connecticut, where they're waiting for me. Why? Now, I've spent a lot of money and a lot of time and a lot of my years of my life trying to find out why. And let me give you some good news and bad news about this. It is possible to find out why you have these emotions in several different therapies. They may be different reasons, but they all seem to be credible. The bad news is, it doesn't help. You wind up feeling crappy and knowing why. The best analogy I've ever been able to think of in the subject, I thought of it 20 years ago, but it's still the best one I ever thought of on that subject. I've lived my life as though I were on the deck of the Titanic, and it hits the iceberg and down it goes, and everybody rows away as fast as they can, and people like me say, I'm not getting off this baby till I find out why this happened. And you may find out why, and it gives you a great feeling of intellectual superiority. You say, you dumbbells in the boats! Ha 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 ha! I know why. And it takes a while to discover knowing why you're going down is of no value. How do you get off the sinking ship? And the greatest help I had in all these years, I had some successes. There was intermittent failures, but intermittent success because I had such a drive. But the greatest help I ever had to see me through was something I paid no attention to. And it's something I discovered. I was a boy, 15 years old, standing on a ship in Pearl Harbor, early in the Second World War, afraid, skinny, dumb, run away from home. And some guys had been having me drink whiskey and watching me throw up and laugh at me, till finally I held a drink of whiskey down in Pearl Harbor. It was terrible. I hated it. And then something happened. Something happened again that I didn't learn for many, many years till I was in AA a long time. I didn't even hardly believe it then. But in retrospect, I know exactly what happened. It turned out that I had a body that was almost instantly, had an almost instant unnatural reaction. I didn't know it was an unnatural reaction at all. I thought that's just the way alcohol made you feel. It made me feel the way those guys looked. And many, many years later, at the end of my run, I stood outside of a Skid Row mission in Los Angeles where I'd just been thrown out. I tried to explain to the guy, I'm not a bum. 3 years ago, I directed a grand opera at the University of Texas. Ads that I wrote are running this month in Life magazine. I've had my picture in the New York Times for achievement. How many people do you know have had their picture in the New York Times for achievement? But it's hard to explain that thing, those things in midair. You know, you just. And I had unfortunately just had my front teeth kicked out in the Phoenix drunk tank. So I couldn't punch out those consonants quite the way I wanted to just. I could have cut them to ribbons if I'd had a break. But I stood outside there, and if someone had come up to me and said, why do you drink? I could have given them reasons why I drink. Childhood reasons. I could have given them metaphysical reasons. I could have given them Nietzschean reasons. I could have given them Uspenskian reasons. I could have given them a lot of reasons. But the one reason I never would have given them, because I never would have, if they'd have told me what it was, I wouldn't have believed it. The real reason was, the same reason I took my second drink. It's the only thing that makes me feel the way men look. That's why I drink. I drink because I want to feel the way they look, because of myself, somehow, it isn't enough. And even if it is enough, people don't know it's enough, so it might as well be not enough. But I didn't stay drunk from that first drink. I tried to learn to handle it over the years. As I grew up, like everything else you find in your teens, you find out things, you try to handle it, you try to learn it, try to drink things that made you look good. When I was in advertising, I drank martinis. I learned to love martinis. I love beer. I love bourbon. I love scotch. I love things. I like to be a drinker because I think drinkers are macho men. But the number one reason is alcohol, as I look back, I now know, was the only thing I ever found that filled my holes. It made me feel complete. It made me feel the way men look. And there's one other thing when I think about it now that I'm sure every one of us have fallen into sometimes without being aware of it, but you might think about it sometimes the next time you're in that mood when you're feeling bad and self-pitying a little bit and feeling different. And you look around you It's an amazing thing. It appears they are all what they seem to be. I'm the only one who has to keep faking it to get along. I'm the only one who has to be a people pleaser. I have to suck around and smile at people I just soon crack in the face, and they can just be as they are and they get along. Why is this? And I think that's one of the reasons people come to AA, one of the things you hear a lot, and they say, I'm tired of being a people pleaser. Well, start with this premise. Everybody who lives in society has to be a people pleaser to one degree or another. I think what they're meaning is they don't want to fall into that sick feeling where they're the only one people pleasing and the others are just what they seem to be. They may not be aware of what they want to get into. But alcohol, to me, provided a compensatory device that made me feel the way men look. And I'll tell you, it wasn't until years later I discovered men don't feel as well as they look. So I was feeling better than all of them for a long time. Alcohol fills my holes, and the only problem I ever had with it, I have an unfortunate tendency to overfill my holes. And when that happens, strange things happen, and I've known to become bizarre, and I've come to realize it's because I was repressed as a child. I burst forth like a spring. I've been hurt a lot. But I try to learn to drink. I spent my adult life doing what the most meaningful description of alcoholism I have ever read, and I've read most of the great treatises on alcoholism, but the greatest one is still that description which that guy wrote without even knowing what the hell he's talking about, Hardman. I, like you, spent much of my life and at times voluntarily hanging on to an obsession, whether I knew it or not, but voluntarily living with the obsession. Somehow, someday, I will control and enjoy my drinking. And the book says the persistence of this illusion is astonishing. Many of us pursued into the gates of insanity and death. And it talks about occasional brief recoveries, which we're all familiar with, followed by still worse relapse, which we're all familiar with. Until you get to what? Till you lose your family or your job? No. Till you get to something just shattering. Pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization. And we've all had that. You can call it a bottom. You know, it's kind of a funny thing. I used to think that was caused by drinking. My experience now tells me that's the feeling you get after you've sobered up. The pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization is, God, you know, most drunks talk about suicide and yammer about how they're going to commit suicide. And they write long, laborious notes, and they just all sorts of turgid things to punish those who've been angry. But most alcoholic suicides, apparently, don't happen when you're drunk. They happen within a short time after you've become sober. And there are no notes for most of them. And there are no big dramatics, because it isn't a matter of proving to them they've been mean to me. It's a matter of pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization. I want to get out. When I went to the insane asylum in Texas, I was there as a successful suicide who had been revived when they found me dead. And I hadn't had a drink for some time. That's one of the reasons I was in that condition. Pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization, despair, hopelessness. These are the feelings of sobriety in this illness. And then here's the odd thing about it. If you can somehow survive that, nature provides a scab over it. And pretty soon you get well enough to drink again and work yourself to another pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization. Till you get a scab over that, then you can do it again. There's an infinite number of bottoms they talk about, and that's what they're talking about. They're not talking about losing your family, your home. You know, I sometimes think about, over the years I've had the opportunity to sponsor, and most people have been sober a long time, different types, and sponsored a guy who was on the moon for a while, and I sponsored a guy who in the last year, when he's at the bottom of his life, he was still making $250,000 a year, and sponsored movie stars, and all this baloney sounds very attractive. But what do we all have in common? They weren't on Skid Row. They didn't stand outside of the mission with their front teeth kicked out. What do we have in common? We have what's described in chapter 3, an obsession that I will control my drinking, followed by pitiful, incomprehensible demoralization. Well, why in the world would we maintain that obsession? And that's one thing that people don't understand about alcoholics, and many alcoholics don't understand about alcoholics. The reason is because life without it is intolerable. I have to find a way to drink, because without it, it just gets terrible. And I was sent to my first AA meeting in 1949. I was 22, which doesn't sound young now, but I was the youngest guy within 20 years that I knew of in that entire area, state. And they used to, I was a kind of a, like a, look at that, the kid's only 22 and he's an AA. People, old fools, would look at me. And I knew I wasn't like them. And I went to AA off and on. The next few years, I went to psychoanalysis. I read books. I did a lot of things. Went to the nut house. Committed suicide. Aaron. At the end of that time, standing on a street corner in Los Angeles, I would bet my life I'm not an alcoholic. I am not an alcoholic. There's something terribly different about me. Now, if I, dying on a street corner in Los Angeles, can prove I'm not an alcoholic, you sure as hell can prove you're not an alcoholic if you work at it. And so can people all around us. As so could I, sitting in a big advertising agency or in a corporation or in a television station and saying, but you don't understand. People would say to me things like, but your problem is, I think you're, maybe your problem is alcohol. And I wouldn't say anything. I knew better than to do that. It didn't take long to understand. You don't talk about it. But I wanted to just shout at them, you think my problem is alcohol? Why don't you go over to my house some morning about 2 o'clock? Maybe you can stand in my bedroom and watch me lie in my bed wide awake and just look out in the darkness and my head going 100 miles an hour and wondering what the hell has happened and why am I not a better father? And I want things to be good, and why is the world so goddamn crappy? And why do people screw me around? And what the hell is wrong with everything? And I want things to be right. You watch me do that for an hour, and you won't think my problem is alcohol. You may understand why I drink, because that's why I drink. I don't drink because I'm a thinker. I drink because I'm a feeler. Well, it's easy for you to laugh. You have no idea what it's like. And so one day I walked 71 blocks in the rain off Skid Row to an AA club I'd been asked to leave, and hung around there, fell into the hands of evil people who were mean to me, didn't share, they told me things, they intimidated me, they frightened me, they hurt me. I lived in the backseat of an abandoned car. There's the AA club property, so there's a certain spiritual fallout. Resented my betters, contemptuous of my inferiors, there's only one or two. And over a period of time, they made me take actions that I thought were... I don't suppose I ever felt worse than I did at certain periods in that early sobriety, because I didn't want to be sober. I wasn't an alcoholic. I was just playing a game to get a score to get out of that sick place. And I've been down a few times. I'd bounced down. I mean, you know, God... One spring I was nominated to be Junior Chamber of Commerce Young Man of the Year in the suburb of Chicago. 6 months later I was playing piano in a semi-whorehouse in San Francisco. And a year later I was directing the Grand Opera University of Texas. And 8 months after that I was in the Texas Insane Asylum. And 2 years after that I was writing ads for Elsie Delmer, the Borden Cow in Dallas. And 6 months after that I was face down, had my teeth kicked out in Phoenix Drunk Tank. I've been up and down a few times. But the one thing, the song had not been written, and if it had been written, it would have been my theme song, you know. I did it my way. And now I wasn't even doing it my way. I was down and out and selling out to these pukes. You know, letting them intimidate me and hating myself for it. Go and apologize to that woman. Why should I? Because you call her a bitch. She is a bitch. Why do you think she's a bitch? She told her newcomer not to go to bed with me. She was very wise. Go and apologize. I discovered one thing in those months. It might be of great help to you if you're an AA new. You never have to believe what you're doing, you just have to do it. Bitch. You don't have to really believe in the amends you make. You don't have to believe in anything. You just have to do it. And somehow I survived, and somehow little by little things changed. And I know it's about dinner time, so I don't take much longer on this. We want to get out of here. I'd like to talk a little bit more about the transition, but I want to tell you one thing. Eventually I lost probably eight jobs, my first eight jobs, and I was sober: dishwasher, furniture mover, busboy, painter. Ugh, I had a bad attitude, and I felt put upon. I lost my job as a dishwasher because I was able to determine the busboys were bringing in more dishes to the kitchen than the waitresses were taking out. Which led me to deduce these guys are getting dishes in other restaurants to humiliate me because I'm an Anglo. I lost my job as a furniture mover first morning. I was not feeling good that morning anyway. He said, "You without the teeth, you bumped my lamp." I said, "No, you're mistaken, sir. I broke your goddamn lamp." You know, you can't push creative people. But I stayed sober. I finally held a job when I was a year sober, wrapping packages in advertising agency. The same kind of job I'd had when I was 14. I knew I was on the AA rocket to stardom now. By the time I was 5 years sober, I was advertising director for a big medical corporation. When I was 7 years sober, I was in Hollywood and radio and television at Slick. And another guy and I created the number one hard rock station in the world, and onward and upward and so on. And it all became very nice. When I was 15 years sober, I was living in West LA and marketing director for a publishing firm in Beverly Hills. Same family, moved out, now sober a few years, had another child, had a bunch of kids, they're all grown up now. And it's very nice. But what I really want to talk about is this. The most important thing I've said tonight, or I'll say before I sit down, I said a long time ago, and none of you paid any attention to it, nor should you. I said, my name is Clancy Imeslin, and I'm an alcoholic. Because how in the world could I be an alcoholic? My problem really is not alcohol. It is, kind of. I've been in jail a lot. I've been in nut houses, and I've been in padded cells, and I've been in veterans hospitals, and I've been chained down in a city hospital while my wife was having a baby on the next floor. I was there a day before she was. That's what you call solicitude, if you don't know. But my problem is not really alcohol. I am so glad that I stayed in AA. I did not get off into other therapies that guided me. The closest I came to it was in 1958. End of 1958, I was brand new, living in the backseat of an abandoned car, and some people came from UCLA, said, "We've got a new breakthrough in the treatment of alcoholism. We need 10 volunteers, known alcoholics." Now, at that time, I was not an alcoholic, but I was also cold in that damn car, I'll tell you. And I looked kind of tawdry and unshaven and dirty shirt. "I'll volunteer." They took my name, but just I wasn't called. So I didn't get to the end of early 1959, big UCLA breakthrough in the treatment of alcoholism by the revolutionary new drug LSD. Most of those people are dead. But there's always somebody who's got a new goddamn method, and they're willing to experiment on you, but they're not going to experiment on me. I stayed in AA long enough and was intimidated long enough to take actions. The only therapy I've had for 31 years and a half now is AA. to discover the most important thing I have ever learned. Now, I'm going to say this, kind of say it slowly, because to me it's the most important thing I will ever say when I'm working with anyone in AA. I had to come to believe and understand that if my problem is alcohol, I am not an alcoholic. And conversely, if I'm an alcoholic, my problem is not alcohol. You say, how can that be? That's crazy. That's some kind of fringe, goofy talk. I am convinced that's the message of AA. That's the message of this book. That's the message of everything we do here. I'm sure I'm one of the very few people in this room who ever sat for an hour and talked to Bill Wilson. And that's what he felt, at least as of 1963. But you say, how can that be? Of course the problem is alcohol. I can disprove that in 10 seconds. If the problem is alcohol, detoxes turn out winners, and they don't. Hospitals turn out winners, they don't. Treatment facilities turn out winners, they don't. Jails turn out winners, they don't. They turn out sober people with varying degrees of information as to what's wrong with them. But if they be true alcoholics, unless something dramatic happens, they must eventually drink again. Well, if it isn't alcohol, what the hell is it? Is it something mysterious, something spooky, something metaphysical they're keeping from us? No, it's something you hear every day, every meeting you go to, and in between meetings. But if you're like me, it'll go right by you unless you catch it. And it's just this, it's something called alcoholism. You say, what's the difference? Alcoholism. Is this going to be some semantic lecture? Not at all. That little difference is the difference between, I think, the most important difference you must learn, because unless you learn it, you must almost certainly die from this illness. Sooner or later, you got to learn it. But what is the difference? Well, a few years ago, I was invited to come down to Orlando, Florida, to address a group of psychiatrists and psychologists on the difference between the psychological profiles and so on. And I really felt sheepish when they called me, because they're going to pay first-class round-trip airfare. And I thought, this is ridiculous. I could tell them over the phone. But then I thought, if I do that, I'll never get to Disney World. So I went down and tap-danced my way through them. But I can tell you in one sentence exactly as much as I told them in an hour. The difference is this. An alcohol problem is overcome by stopping drinking. In this strange, denigrating, emotionally rending, conflict-causing, eventually insanity-provoking, eventually lethal thing called alcoholism, you will discover sooner or later that stopping drinking as such has no significant effect on your life other than to gradually make it so painful that you can't stand it. The lethal and fatal aspect of the disease of alcoholism is that eventually I cannot stand sobriety. But even that doesn't make you an alcoholic. That just makes you ready to be an alcoholic. There are hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of thousands of people who have all the emotions you and I do that we think are unique unto us, who are not alcoholics. They are what science calls intense or acute neurotics. They are people who live in reality. They're not insane, they're not psychotic, but they are live with emotions and exceedingly intense emotions and immature emotions and obsessions and reactions. And it's one crisis after another and conflict. They are the people who fill the psychiatric couches. They are the people for whom drugs such as Librium and Valium and Darvon and so on were slow them down, hold them down so their intensity doesn't eat them up. Some of these people drink alcohol every day and they can never become alcoholic. Now, isn't that strange? What the hell is it makes an alcoholic? Isn't it the emotions? Nope. You must be one of the 5 or 6% of people who drink who get an unnatural reaction to alcohol. that does not come, it seems to have been that way as far back as they can remember. Study. There's always a small percentage of people in biblical times who should not look upon the wine when it is red. In Assyrian times, in Egyptian times, in Greek times, every civilization has had a group of people who react differently to alcohol. Now they figured maybe 5 or 6%, but it's a small group. What is this unnatural reaction? How can you tell if you're an alcoholic? Because I'll tell you, realistically speaking, that is what makes an alcoholic. Everything else is secondary. If you have that unnatural reaction to alcohol, you are an alcoholic no matter what the rest of your life is like. If you don't have that unnatural reaction to alcohol, you are not an alcoholic no matter how dingy you may think you are. That is what makes an alcoholic. They say, isn't it the same as narcotic addiction? No, it isn't, for several reasons, but one obvious one is that anyone who shoots an addictive drug or takes an addictive drug will become addicted to drugs. I don't care who you are. You take enough morphine and you'll become addicted to morphine. If you take enough barbiturates, you'll become addicted to barbiturates, whether you mean to or not. But you can drink alcohol as much as you can drink, as long as you can, and you will never become an alcoholic unless you get that unnatural reaction to alcohol that only happens to a few people. A lot of people wish they were alcoholics when they see us. They don't realize the entrance requirements are rather distressing. But what is this unnatural reaction? Well, sometimes if you hear speakers say, I stayed drunk around the clock for 25 years. You think, now that's an unnatural reaction. But I'll tell you something. It is physically impossible for a human body to stay intoxicated 14 straight days and nights in a laboratory. You always get sober. That's one of the rottenest parts about being a drinker. You keep getting sober again and again. If you could stay drunk, we'd have a very small membership here tonight, I'll tell you that. You'd have a different speaker. I would still be the toast of the Chinese palace in downtown Juarez, Chihuahua, Mexico. I'm back again, Ming. You lucky spicks. Is it that you can't handle alcohol? That must be it. False. Alcoholics handle alcohol better than social drinkers in almost any given test situation. If they all drink the same, if you've been to a party where everybody drinks the same, I will bet if you're an alcoholic that you drive them home. But the point is you can't get them to drink the same. Because they say things like, oh, no more for me, I'm starting to feel it. And you want to say, why don't you feel this, you wussy? You know. In fact, we just had another Christmas season in California. I don't know if they do it in your states, but in our states, they've now had it approved by the Supreme Court. There could be random stops of motorists to catch drunken drivers at Christmas time. They're not trying to catch people like you and me who know how to drive when we're drinking. They're trying to catch social drinkers who are out there on their annual Christmas binge, bumping into trees and each other and cars, and while honest citizens like you and us have to sit behind them and say, hurry up there for Christ's sake. What is it? What does alcohol do to me it doesn't do to 95% of people? Nothing that I know of. Nothing. It does less to me than it does to normal drinkers anything. I could drink my entire family under the table tonight if they were here. If I had something to drink, if I wanted to kill myself later. It turns out, I learned in AA that one thing I never would have guessed, because it never came up in the conversation, what makes an alcoholic, the unnatural reaction is, it has to do something special for you that it doesn't do for most people. It almost instantly must alter your perception of reality. Boom. it must almost instantly change your relationship to your environment. It must almost instantly make me taller and more self-contained, and them smaller and less fortunate, less frightening to me. It must almost instantly fill my holes. And I never guessed once it didn't do that to others. When they didn't drink, it just meant they didn't need to have that done. I was the only one empty. And that's, you know, that unusual reaction comes at different times in different lives. That's why you can't go on other people's stories sometimes. Because years ago, it used to be people drank for 25 years. Now we know that people sometimes drink for 10 years before they get that reaction. Some people drink for 5 years before many people get it the first time they ever drink, and they don't even know it. The people that drank a long time before they get the reaction, that's where the invisible line comes in. They drank, and then one day they're drinking differently for a different reason. That's why this dichotomy in AA, sometimes we have an old speaker get up and say, I drank for 30 years, and look accusingly at some little snot in the front row, as if to say, you're not even 30 years old. How the hell do you know that you're an alcoholic, you little snot? And they don't realize the little snot is sitting there thinking, you can't be much of an alcoholic if you lasted 30 years, you old son of a bitch. It turns out it isn't how long you drank, it's when it begins to kick in. And there's only one thing wrong with that. I'll tell you this, alcohol, the effect of alcohol, if alcohol is working, I don't know any other better way to say it. You know, it brings about a momentary omnipotence. It works better than, I've been working with addicts for a lot of years, and I don't know of any drug that works as effectively as alcohol in an alcoholic. Heroin gets you down goofy, away from it all, but very relatively soon you have to overdose to get there. Your body cannot tolerate it. You always have to have someone with you because you're going to die from an overdose because you got to take more and more. Cocaine gets you way up high, and it's all very romantic and very pleasant, but eventually the paranoia comes. It comes with speed and the desperation and the terrible addiction. Alcohol puts you right in the middle, right where you are. The holes are filled. You with anyone, Granny? Take your job and shove it, Mr. Collins. You want to fight copper? You may wonder later why you did these things, but the only thing wrong with it is this. If it does that for you, it eventually has to begin taking a toll. So you're going to quit. Then you realize reality is where the pain was. So you drink. And then you get sober. And you try these things in Chapter 3, changing from scotch to brandy and taking physical exercise and the ad infinitum of things. But the net result is you drink till you stay sober. You stay sober till you drink. And you just do this again and again, and that's called alcoholism. And nearly everybody who has it dies from it, convinced, but I'm not really an alcoholic. My problems came when I was sober. Don't you understand that? And the reason that's important to remember, so that you will not get caught up in that terrible morass of thinking, you're going to come here and get sober and sit in these rooms, and you're going to get better. You're going to get better for a little while, but pretty soon you're going to get worse. Being sober is the deadly end of alcoholism. The purpose of AA is not to make you holy. It's not to make you wonderful. It may happen. The purpose of AA is not to make you superhuman. No matter how hard you work the program, you'll never rise above fallible human being. The purpose of these steps and this involvement in the context of the fellowship of AA and the actions that get obsessed minds off themselves onto others. The purpose of this gets lost in the shovel sometimes. But I'll tell you what I believe it to be is to do slowly what alcohol does quickly. The purpose of AA is to little by little alter my perception of reality, to little by little change my relationship to my environment, to little by little make me taller and more self-contained, and them less frightening, to begin to fill my holes. That's what it's about. It isn't a do-gooderism thing. That's why we suggest you do it. And I would suggest you get a sponsor that intimidates you just a little bit, because you have more prone to do that than you ever will for a sponsor who's a chum, because sometimes your life depends on it. And the net result, of course, is that little by little things change, but it happens slowly and imperceptibly. And it's hard to remember that, so we have to. I keep going to AA regularly now after a lot of years. I haven't heard anything new in an AA meeting in 20 years. But I always feel better when I leave because it refocuses what I already know. And that's what it's about. You don't get sick like this. Boom. You get sick like this. Oh, God. Well, I've got it under control. Oh, Jesus. Oh. And you don't get better like this. When you hear speakers say, and then it became wonderful. That isn't the way it is in life. It goes like this. Oh, I found AA is working. Oh, Jesus Christ. Ah. And it's easy to get discouraged, and it's easy to get caught up in your own obsessions. That's why we suggest you keep doing these things. That's why we suggest you keep finding new people. And if nothing else, simulating interest in what they're saying. Till you can get an interest. That you take the actions of AA. And you're not going to become wonderful. You're not going to become perfect. There's a lot of people around AA, as there has always been since 1935. Or at least 36, who say AA is a nice place to get sober. But if you have deep emotional problems, you need more intense therapies. Or you may need this medication that special people need. Or you may have to go to organizations that'll prove it's somebody else's fault, hopefully your parents. Or you may have to do something. That may be true for emotionally upset people. As I told you, I've been in jail 34 times, which is not a record, but that's good for advertising executives. I've been committed to spend my life in the Texas Insane Asylum. This reform will work at least 30 times. If you're real, the people don't treat you special, and the people don't really treat you like you're a visiting Duke. Oh, hi. And then you discover what AA is about. You take actions that now enable you to live. I'm very, very glad. The last thing I want to say in one sentence, I'm also glad that I eventually came to believe in my sponsor, who had me do things that I came to believe in AA, which eventually got me to believe in God. I would have bet my life I would never go back to a Norwegian Lutheran church. And the last time I was in the Norwegian Lutheran Church with my mother's little casket a few years ago, I remember just looking around thinking, isn't that wonderful? I misread it so badly. God in the Norwegian Lutheran Church is the same kindly God that's in the meetings in Los Angeles. I just didn't know it. So the great miracle of AA to me is this, that I can come stand on this podium tonight and say, my name is Clancy Immisland, and I'm an alcoholic. Huh. And through the power of 12 steps, huh, who would have believed that? And the grace of a loving God, who would have ever believed that? Through the steps of AA and the grace of a loving God, I can live with a degree of dignity I never thought possible for a sick, lost, frightened animal such as myself. And I'm going to continue doing it, and I hope you do it too. Thank you.
I'd like to thank Clancy again for a great main talk. Would everyone please stay after the Lord's Prayer for the SVI announcements? After a moment of silent meditation, I would ask Annette G. to lead us in the Lord's Prayer.
Thank you. Everybody hold on just one.